Silence in court.
I'm Lucy Worsley, and in my brand new series, I'll be hearing about the women involved in some of history's most infamous legal battles.
I am a rebel, whatever verdict the jury passes on me.
And with an all-female team of detectives, I'll be reopening extraordinary court cases from the past.
I did it! He only got what he deserved!
Lady on Trial with Lucy Worsley. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 3 Unwind, you can hear Classical Wind Down with Niall Breslin. Listen on your digital radio or just ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3 Unwind. But now on Radio 3 at 5 o'clock, it's time for our weekly dedicated hour of early music. Here's Hannah French.
Welcome to the Early Music Show, Radio 3's home of Bach and beyond. Trumpets are the order of the day today, and we begin in Versailles.
Lully's Prelude of Trumpets for Mars. Jordi Savall directed Le Concert des Nations. The Heralds of Versailles opening today's early music show as producer Les and I are bound for the seaside. We're off to visit trumpeter Crispian Steele Perkins at his home on the south coast of England. As you might imagine, he has one or two trumpets waiting for us, instruments that feed his insatiable thirst for clues into pitch, how it's changed over the centuries. So we're genning up on the way down, listening to Crispian's many recordings. And first up is this, the Concerto for Two Trumpets in C by Antonio Vivaldi.
Thank you.
Vivaldi's Concerto in C for two trumpets. That was the Parley of Instruments with soloists Christian Steele Perkins and Alison Balsam. And we've arrived by the sea in East Sussex to meet Christian at home where he's, well, frankly, surrounded by trumpets. And we're under the watchful gaze of portraits of trumpeters gone by. Christian, thanks for having us.
You're very, very welcome indeed.
Now, thus far, we've heard in the car trumpets in France and Italy. And although there are many similarities between these instruments across the continent, there's one big difference, and that's pitch, right?
That is the big difference. It's quite hard to explain, but what I find is that if you can actually find the instruments that were around and played and known to have been used and not subsequently tampered with, it's going to tell us quite a lot. I think I should explain that my interests are not only music, but also I've always been very keen on archaeology. And in archaeology, you allow the artefact to tell you the tale itself. You can't invent it and make your views fit round it. It has to be the other way around. So hopefully we'll cover that a little bit later on.
So France and Italy, famously contrasting, the French pitch was low, the Italian pitch was very high. I mean, are we talking about an interval of what A could differ between about a minor third across the continent?
Yes, in parts of England, it varied up to a fourth in the century previously, which heaven knows how people... But we have incontrovertible proof that, in fact, in Purcell's day, pitch was a whole tone lower than it is now. Andrew Parrott realised this, and when we recorded the Te Deum and Jubilate of Henry Purcell, we played it at a whole tone down from modern pitch. And it does sound quite different, and it enables the voice and the trumpet to blend very nicely, I think.
Thank you.
That was the Taverner Consort and Players, directed by Andrew Parrott, with Crispian Steele Perkins, the trumpeter, in Purcell's anthem, Jubilate Deo. Crispian, the Purcell was adopting a lower pitch at the end of the 17th century in Restoration England. The royal court spent so long in France. It seems understandable, but what happens when you bring new musicians into the fray? I'm thinking about the German Handel arriving via Italy.
I'm almost certain that the pitch was pretty much the same as it had been during Purcell's lifetime. It went up fairly swiftly afterwards. But bear in mind the fact that the singer of Eternal Source of Light, Handel's first work that he wrote as a commission from royalty, uses the same singer, of whom the Princess Anne, as she had been, had loved the sound of the trumpet. And Handel, being canny, obviously imitates Purcell, using the singer he was familiar with and the trumpet, the very first commission from royalty. Whenever I worked, as I did many times, with Rogers, Covey, Crumpt, I always thought to myself, that's the Richard Elford sound. Elford's name is actually written on the score as the part to be said, Mr. Elford.
So that's something we know for sure.
We certainly know it for sure.
Thank you.
from Handel's Ode for the Birthday of Queen Anne, Eternal Source of Light Divine, with countertenor James Bowman and trumpeter Crispian Steele Perkins, my guest in this early music show here on Radio 3, direct from his living room, festooned with trumpets. Crispian, just tell us a little more about the instrument that you played on that recording.
That was the first time that I experimented with using an older mouthpiece. That they're much bigger and deeper, and the great thing about mouthpieces of olden times is they seem to cut out those high frequencies of that aggressive sound that you need in a symphony orchestra.
Right.
Don't forget, at that time I was still principal trumpeter of the Royal Philharmonic, so I was going out from doing early music recordings straight to play a Mahler symphony. But I had, in the mid-70s, bought a trumpet from olden times, and I realised that it couldn't be played in the way that we play a modern trumpet. You had to approach it differently.
Yeah. Now, what do we know about the trumpeters who played for Purcell and Handel?
Quite a lot. Possibly Eternal Source was played by John Baptist Grano, who was the... He certainly played the first water music performance 2 years later.
And John Shaw, clearly a close personal friend of Purcell.
Indeed. And Purcell also had a very soft spot for his sister Catherine and wrote pieces for them to perform together.
Okay. And put your archaeologist hat back on again.
Mm.
What about hard evidence? What can we measure?
Well, the wonderful thing about Shaw's personal instrument that he owned, it was measured. It absolutely clearly, every part of it was taken apart and measured, and we know the exact length from the mouthpiece right down to the bell.
Why did they do that? Were they looking to copy it? Or...
James Talbot was just interested to find out, and he wrote it all down. It's a bit difficult to decipher, but we've done so. And of course, the instrument comes out at 7 foot 2 inches without the mouthpiece. The mouthpiece is 4.5 inches long. I've got one to show you.
Great.
Put them all together, and you've got 7 foot 6. 7 foot 6 on a tube produces at A440, our modern pitch, the note D flat.
Oh.
All trumpets were constructed in E flat. Many of the books about say they were built in D. They were not. They were always built in E flat. The trouble is they were measured in the late 19th and early 20th century. And because they were the same length as a D trumpet, but they weren't. It was pitch was lower. They were made in E flat. So all the scholars were actually, because it's a logical thing to decide. Oh, it's in D. That's why Handel wrote in D, why Purcell wrote in D and all that. But in fact, they were always crooked down and they had little tuning bits. Again, in Mr. Talbot's description, he measures every single bit of them. And I've got them on the table here to show you. Should I blow a couple of notes on it so you can just hear the sound of it? And then I'll show you what happened with regard to pitch and why we know they were playing a semitone lower. Apart from, if this is in E flat. It's a much sort of chuffier sound. You can't hear the tongue. There's no hard edge to it, but that means that the sound will blend with the voice even better. So that's why I wanted to start using proper old mouthpieces. The thing is, now, to put it into D, as it was in those days, the measurements are very clear. This is a loop which comes from later in the century, about 1780. It's 5 inches long, which is... was necessary once the instrument's shorter. We know from the records that in fact to lower the pitch by half a tone, what Mr. Shaw had was 7 inches. So I'm going to add this, which adds 2 inches to it. And then you'll find it is actually bang on a 392.
So, Crispian, each time adding a very specific length of tubing, whether it's curled or
correct,
a short straight piece,
yes,
lowers the tone.
It does. The fact of the matter is that now, with this additional piece of tubing, it's at D, as Purcell knew it, but if we took it over to a piano and put down a middle C, you'll find that that is the note that comes out. That tells us absolutely definitively that pitch was a whole tone lower in the time of Purcell than it is now.
Well, let's put this into practice. Let's hear a recording of you playing this very instrument in a moment from Handel's Messiah.
And we shall be changed.
The trumpet shall sound. Bass David Thomas, trumpeter Chris Bloomsteel Perkins, with the Tavern of Players, directed by Andrew Parrott. You're listening to the Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3, coming to you directly from Chris Bloomsteel's cottage on the south coast, where we're his guests alongside a troupe of trumpets, and he's ours on the airwaves. Chris Bloomsteel Perkins, on one level, the idea of pitch being so variable is liberating, and on another, it's a complete headache. For musicians at the time, the thought that A isn't A from the piano would be terrible for anyone in these modern times who has perfect pitch. But we know that it's still centuries before pitch is standardized or fixed. So yes. Whenever we play 18th century music, it could land anywhere. I mean, I love the legend, whether it's true or not, that agreeing on A at 440 was one of the last peaceful agreements before World War II broke out across the continent. But for now, for the 18th century, it's on the rise. And we know it's on the rise, yeah?
It happened fairly suddenly.
Okay.
Because, again, the instruments that have survived tell you that. The trumpet I was playing on that last recording was made by Harris in about 1720. But it was converted into a slide trumpet, which was sort of came into being around 1790, in order to correct the bad notes of the tuning of the trumpet. As volume got louder, in other words, the orchestras were much bigger, and therefore the volume notch were turned up, the out-of-tune natural harmonics of the trumpet became excruciatingly painful. There's a famous performance of Messiah in Westminster Abbey, performed by a choir of 1,000 and an orchestra of well over 80. Charles Burney complained about the tuning of James Sargent, the trumpeter, said every time he plays the 11th harmonic, that is the G natural in the trumpet shall sound, the audience winced. No trumpet can cope once it goes that turning point. And that's why we needed slides, vent holes, hand stopping, anything to try and cure the 11th and 13th harmonics, which were absolutely excruciating, and you could not let them down.
Is there a bit of a chicken and egg scenario going on in terms of what composers are writing for the instrument and what the instrument is able to do, and then the technological advances? So I'm thinking by the time we reach Haydn, we've got chromaticism. We're moving away from fanfares and we're playing melodies.
Haydn loved the sound of the trumpet, and he added it to his symphonies. You know, when trumpets were available, he would write a trumpet part as long as it's in the right key. But the most interesting thing is that in the early 1790s, of course, Haydn came to London. One of his very best friends back in Austria was Anton Weidinger, the court trumpeter. Mm-hmm. Haydn was a witness at his marriage, and he was godfather to his eldest son. This isn't just a professional acquaintance. This is actual personal friendship. So he would have been very interested to see these London trumpeters experimenting with slides and especially with vent holes on these instruments. And without any doubt, as soon as he got back to see his friend in Austria, he would have told him about what the experiments. And Weidinger took the idea to heart. And as we know, he built the first properly, fully chromatic trumpet, for which Haydn wrote the most marvellous concerto. And the trumpet here is playing proper music for the very first time, fully chromatic, very expressive, phrasing like any other wind instrument.
the slow movement of Haydn's Trumpet Concerto. My guest today, Crispian Steele-Perkins, with the King's Consort. Crispian, rising pitch. For all the adaptations, it fundamentally changed the trumpet. As you say, it's now a fully expressive chromatic instrument. But yet there is still so much variation. There are still these instruments that have been hanging around. People didn't put away the instruments that they'd had in order just to play the newest, did they? There was all sorts going on with some composers writing the very new, others still loving that regal sound and the fanfare.
That is correct. The key trumpet took a long time to be adapted to. It was played at the King's Theatre by the Gambatti brothers from Italy, and they were playing in the King's Theatre in the 1820s, and people said it was a raw, rough sound. There is an unevenness between the notes, but the art of playing the instrument is to try and disguise that. But of course, as we were talking about earlier, if they're trying to play a key trumpet loudly in an orchestra or in an opera pit, it ain't going to sound great, I'm afraid. It will show up.
I mean, Beethoven is an interesting case in point, isn't it?
Yes. Beethoven writes quite differently from the trumpet than any other composer, from the composers before him. He starts off really in fairly Haydn-esque style in the first two symphonies, but the trumpet writing is very simplistic. He uses the trumpet almost to embellish the drums. He regards the drum as the heartbeat of the orchestra, and the significance, the symbolism of the trumpet rather faded, I think.
But the instruments that we're surrounded by, I guess even by Mendelssohn's day, these are still the instruments that players are playing.
Well, for example, I've got a cornet over there that was made in 1837. Berlioz was writing for the cornets in his Symphonie Fantastique and travelling all round Europe. So that one, which is fully playable now, made in 1837, it's extraordinary, really. And may I say, bang on a 440 pitch.
Which is what we accept as modern pitch, A on the piano.
Yes.
But this idea of that period, Mendelssohn, where now we've standardised A430, which kind of sits between the semitone, almost a half semitone, it's seemingly a useful standardisation, but not really rooted in any historical fact.
No, it's back of a fag packet stuff. It's halfway between 415 and 440. I remember that coming in, but as I say, I've never come across a brass instrument at that pitch. I may be wrong, but I have, let's face it, I've recorded on them, I've bought them, sold them. I've never come across an instrument anywhere near 430.
Crispian, we've seen today how pitch rose from the lowest of the French pitches in the 17th century up to where we are now, and then we've tried to standardise it, however successful that may have been. And now we have our ideas of Baroque pitch, whether it's low Baroque pitch, high Baroque pitch. We've been quite rude about classical A is 430 pitch. But in lots of ways, we need pitch to be standardised. Those headaches that the variation in pitch gave instrumentalists in the 18th century, they're still here now.
I've experienced that. When Pope John Paul II was appointed, they wanted to put on a concert of all the Brandenburg concertos with the Polish Chamber Orchestra in St. Cecilia's Hall in Rome. Very important. They didn't have a trumpet player who could play those sort of music, and they recommended me to go out there. My flight was delayed due to a strike. I got to Rome, to the hall, about 20 minutes before the beginning of the concert. I'd not got there for the rehearsal, and the manager was going berserk. Brandenburg II was opening the show, and so I said, look, I know the piece, I must just tune to the harpsichord. My little piccolo trumpet, you know, they're very short, put down the A, and I thought, that doesn't sound right. They still played at high pitch, nearly a semitone sharp. There's no way you can get in tune. It wasn't my greatest moment. Mercifully, pitch is fairly standardised now.
Thank you. the end of Johann Sebastian Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2, Tafelmusik with Crispian Steele Perkins on trumpet. Well, I suppose pitch settles, doesn't it?
It has to.
And I suppose the thing is that people get caught out when the pitch rises, because it's much easier to flatten.
Yes.
And to accommodate lower pitch than it is a higher one. And I suppose that's when you get the advances in technology or just cutting instruments at a different length.
Especially when the volume is going up. On a wind instrument, it's almost impossible to lip up. It really is impossible. Whereas you do automatically lip down. And when you're in a big orchestra, in a big acoustic, it's human nature, you'll tend a bit sharp. So you've got room to lip it down if the going gets tough. When orchestras suddenly became big, that's why it happened quickly.
Yeah. And that's the essence, isn't it, therefore, of pitch rising?
I've concluded that is the case, yes.
Crispian, this has been a rare treat. Thank you for having us, for entertaining and educating us in the best possible way. Let's end now with you playing Bach. You've chosen a moment from a cantata. Why is that?
I enjoyed this. I'd worked for John Elliott Gardiner for 15 years. And on this particular recording, I'm using the bell of an instrument like the very first one I showed you. And it's got that darker sound. Even though I'm using a modern Baroque trumpet with vent holes, I do think it has the essence of the sound that Bach knew.
Archaeologist to the end.
Archaeologist to the end, yes.
Thank you.
the opening chorus of Bach's Cantata No. 147. John Elliott Gardner conducted the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists. The solo trumpeter was Crispian Steele Perkins, who was Hannah French's guest on today's Early Music Show. It was produced in Salford by Les Pratt.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
This week is really the story of America in the 20th century, a country seeking its own distinct identity and waiting for a figure to define it culturally. In Leonard Bernstein, they found that defining figure. We'll follow Bernstein's truly meteoric rise to stardom, and with America at war, we'll hear his response to the conflict.
Composer of the Week.
Exploring the music of Leonard Bernstein. Tomorrow afternoon from 4. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Over on Radio 3 Unwind, it's Classical Wind Down with Niall Breslin. Listen on your digital radio. But here on Radio 3, it's 6 o'clock and time for this week's Choral Evensong, which was recorded in Portsmouth Cathedral and first broadcast on Wednesday for the feast of the birth of John the Baptist. The service includes music by Bevan and Gibbons and opens now with an introit by Bird. Sing joyfully unto God our strength.